Hi there, welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm your host, Carla Nappi. I just had a really great time talking with Christopher Nugent about his recent book, Manifest in Words Written on Paper, Producing and Circulating Poetry in Tang Dynasty China, that came out with the Harvard University Asia Center in 2010. Now, this is an extraordinarily thoughtfully produced book. It's an award-winning book. And you can see after sort of reading through it, and hopefully you'll get a sense of this from listening to Christopher talk about it, just why that is. It's a book that is very focused and very explicit about being focused on a very local case study, that is the production and experience of poetry in Tang Dynasty China, but the kinds of issues that come up in the course of this study. Issues like, how do we think about texts as material objects? What's the relationship between orality and the art of writing in producing a document or a text? What does it involve and what has it involved and what can it involve to form a collection of the works of an individual author? And when you kind of mess with all of the assumptions that we take for granted about all of these things, how might that change the way we think of authorship and the way we think of a work, an original work or original work of art, as being some unified, unitary thing? It's a very, very rich study. It was great fun talking with Christopher about it, and I hope you enjoy. Hello, Christopher.
Hi, Carla.
We're here today at New Books in East Asian Studies to talk with Christopher Nugent about his book, Manifest in Words Written on Paper, Producing and Circulating Poetry in Tang Dynasty China. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Christopher. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Well, thanks for asking me.
Well, this is a great book, and I'll just sort of mention, I'll get this right on the table. I was really excited about reading this, and that excitement persisted throughout the process, and I'm still excited right now. It's one of the great things about this, and I'm really looking forward to talking to you over the course of this hour, because I know this is going to come out, even though the study is very focused and you're very clear about this, on a very specific case, there are really wide-ranging implications for other fields, for a lot of other fields, I think, based on what you're doing here. And it's really made me think about and look at poetry completely differently. So thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Christopher, could you start us out, as is kind of typical for New Books in East Asian Studies, by telling us a little bit about what brought you to this field? Why history of Chinese literature, and why this topic in particular?
Yeah, I guess in terms of what brought me into the field, it was a pretty circuitous route. When I started in college, I thought I was interested in colonial U.S. history, a topic in which I never ended up taking a single class. I had had kind of a vague, rebellious Catholic interest in Buddhism and other things that seemed at the time as far away from Catholicism as I could imagine. And I somewhat on a whim took a course on Asian religions my first semester in college, and then took a long series of much more focused courses in college with Hal Roth on Buddhism, and mostly on Taoism, but on, you know, Chinese thought, early Chinese thought in general. And I really found myself taken with a lot of aspects of Buddhist doctrine, certain aspects of, I guess, broadly speaking, Buddhist aesthetics and Buddhist philosophy. And as I got more interested in that, I found myself wanting to know more and more about the context. So I did more courses on Chinese history, mostly earlier Chinese history, also courses in philosophy, philosophy of religion, philosophy of language, especially. I was actually a religious studies major through this as an undergraduate. Some courses on Chinese art with Maggie Bickford. And I just kind of, it kept building on itself, wanting to know more and more about the context, and eventually started language training quite late, actually, not until my junior year in college. After college, I was actually, originally I thought I wanted to go to grad school, then I thought I wanted to drop all of it. And I lived in China for a couple of years and came back and decided, indeed, I wanted to go to grad school. And when I started grad school, I actually thought I still wanted to do something with Buddhism, maybe something about the intellectual interactions of Song Dynasty Confucians and Buddhists at the time, and started grad school thinking that that's what I was going to do. But I ended up taking some classes early on with Stephen Owen, and I found them, both the classes and him, and I guess also the material, really inspiring and moved me in a way that thinking about Buddhist and Confucian doctrine hadn't quite moved me. And so I actually shifted my third year in grad school, I guess, second or third year, I guess it was in the second year, to literature. And to be honest, at that time, I knew very little about Chinese literature. I actually had never taken a Chinese literature course as an undergrad, and it really started in grad school. But it was a combination of a great advisor, really interesting material, and also at that time I felt a really engaging group of fellow grad students that were wonderful to work with and wonderful to be in class with and to talk with and to learn things from. And obviously I've kept going with it since then.
That's really inspiring. And it also, I think, helps explain what's a very, at least for the reader, obvious feature of the book, which is its really clear, wide intellectual range. I think one of the things I was going to ask you about later on, and we'll get to this in the course of the book, is to talk a little bit about what seems to be an interest in bringing the kinds of phenomena and the kinds of ways of looking at texts that you are bringing to poetry in this book to other fields. Like you mentioned religious studies very explicitly at several points, and this is actually kind of explaining a little bit of where that might have come from.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and in fact, you know, my undergraduate thesis was dealing with Gong'an, with, you know, encounter dialogue koans in the Tang and Song. And though I actually hadn't thought about this through much of grad school when I was looking at literature, but when I was working on the dissertation and thinking back on questions that had been important to me, I realized that my undergraduate thesis had dealt with a particular type of dialogue that in which transition between oral and written forms actually played a key role. And I looked at it in a much more superficial way as an undergraduate because, you know, my thought was more superficial and my language skills were really lacking at that point. But I realized that there is an interest in this kind of movement from early on, and questions about the materiality of texts that are texts and things that are later on dealt with in a less material way.
So this is, in the acknowledgments of the book, you mentioned that this is a book that came originally from a dissertation. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that process of transforming this from a dissertation to a book manuscript? Were there any major changes, major transformations? What was the process like for you?
I think one of the one aspect that I think dominated was really questions of writing. I mean, the dissertation was written very much in a dissertation mode, where a lot of it was getting things down on paper, getting findings down, trying to do one's best to get the implications down, but not paying as much attention as would be ideal to prose and the way arguments were really formulated and structured. And I think one of the big challenges of that transition from dissertation to book was moving away from, and I guess this actually works well with the topic, but a sort of more oral mode of expression, which is my natural way of writing, and trying to craft it into something that was that presented its arguments in a better, more cohesive way. And you know, I'd like to think that I made a lot of progress in that transition, but it was also a transition in which I got a lot of help from other people. And you know, my wife was also in the field, was a wonderful reader of every single word I wrote in both the dissertation and the book, and helping me see how to get the prose to work better in a written form. Another big transition for me was just the opportunity to look much more deeply at a lot of these questions and to go back and look for new sources and new materials that in some cases added to the arguments that I already had made, but in a lot of cases changed them as well. And I think that was probably more true for the chapter dealing with memory than for any of the other chapters. I really pretty radically rethought my ideas about how memory was working in this period, in the course of writing the book as opposed to the dissertation. There were some things that a lot of new work went into that don't produce that much change, I think, ultimately in the book. The whole chapter on Qinfuyin, the Dunhuang text, I went back and redid all of the research for that, essentially. I took the texts, the manuscripts, and blew them up again on the computer and again went through character by character, sometimes holding a microscope up over a printed version of these things, trying to figure out what this character was, and then changed completely the way that I counted them. Originally, I had done kind of variation across a set of eight texts instead of doing it through the pairs. Mm-hmm. And the pairs, the counting was much more time-consuming, but I think the result that it came up with was much more interesting and persuasive. And then, of course, there's just the larger question of organization. You know, how do you put all these things together in a way that's making not only a lot of sub-arguments, but also a larger argument that's going to be a meaningful contribution to the literature? And you know, as academics, we're obviously always working under different incentives. You know, we want to get the dissertation done so we can go out and get a job. We want to get the first book done so we can get tenure. And but at the same time, we want to do something meaningful. And I think that I had the time with the book to focus more on doing something that I felt and I hoped at least was meaningful and would add to the field.
That's great. Now, the book, you've mentioned these Dunhuang manuscript copies of this poem that dominates the first chapter. So I want to ask you about that. But first, just to say for listeners who may not yet have had a chance to read the book, and this is a book that came out in 2010, the book itself is a study of poetry that's focused in the Tang Dynasty. And there are a couple of major issues that, as we move through the book, you raise as a way of thinking about how to kind of approach the creation and circulation of poetry materially. So there's a focus on the materiality of poetry. There's a focus on kind of rethinking the way we understand authorship to work. Mm-hmm. These poems. And you take us through, as you mentioned, chapters on textual variation in these manuscripts in Dunhuang. There's a chapter on memory practices, a chapter on orality, on writing in the creation and circulation of poetry. And then finally, we look at, before the conclusion, we look at compilations of works in the Tang. So let's actually move through some of this and get right into the work. So you've already mentioned this poem, the Qinfuyin So this is probably a good place to start. The particular focus of the first chapter is on this set of 8 manuscript copies of this poem from Dun Huang. Can you talk a little bit about what that poem is for listeners who may not be familiar with this, and why you chose this as an important set of documents for looking at these issues?
Sure. The poem is a very lengthy narrative poem by an author named Wei Zhuang, who's writing in the late Tang. And it's a story of this woman moving through geographically through these different areas and what she encounters along the way. It's interesting. I realize now that I haven't reread the poem in a very long time. And when I was working on it, of course, I was working on it in such little bits and pieces that sometimes one definitely did lose the forest for the trees. It's an unusual poem in some ways. It's the longest surviving poem from the Tang. So by that fact alone, it's unusual. It's 1,666 characters, the basic poem. Obviously, there's variation in there. And as someone who was brought up Catholic, that number always drove me crazy for superstitious reasons. It was interesting on a number of levels. We know it was very popular at the time, not long after its composition. You know, so popular that Wei Zhuang gets closely associated with that poem in his lifetime. But the poem disappears, and it's not recorded anywhere after the Song. And until we found the Dun Huang manuscripts, nobody had read the poem for many, many hundreds of years. And I think it was Herbert Giles who was looking through the manuscripts that had been shall we say, pilfered and brought ultimately to the British Museum. And he was looking at this manuscript and he saw these two lines that he recognized as lines that were quoted in a miscellany from the Tang from this poem, Qin Fuyin, that was no longer extant. And he realized he was, you know, quite possibly the first person in many, many centuries to have a copy of that poem in front of him. And there are a number of other copies that were found. I look at 8. There are fragments that were also found. There may be other copies there as well. So you have a poem that we know was very popular in its own time, that then disappeared and never made it into the print culture in the Song. And then we have rediscovered. So that in and of itself, I think, says interesting things about certain types of authority. On top of that, for more almost logistical reasons for what I was trying to do, the fact that it's very long and the fact that there were so many copies of it, there's no other poem with that many copies of it that we found from Dun Huang, made it very, very useful for this kind of textual analysis, looking at variants over a number of manuscripts. The fact that all of these manuscripts were found, you know, really in a single room makes that even more interesting. It's one thing to say that, you know, this medieval text where we have a copy from Italy and we have another copy from Ireland has a lot of variation. It's something else to say that these two scrolls that had been sitting next to each other in this cave for thousands of years actually have a really high degree of variation.
Mm-hmm. Now, you use this collection of manuscripts of this particular poem to bring us into the issues of materiality. This really starts us off thinking in these terms, and this proceeds for the rest of the book. Now, among the issues that you raise in terms of the thinking materially about poems, these include the taking seriously the format of a manuscript. So you mentioned the important difference between the production and reading of a poem if it's a scroll form versus a bound booklet. You talk about the process of what it might have been like to copy these manuscripts. And you've already mentioned that one of the things that you do in this chapter that's, I think, really fascinating is to do a kind of data analysis of the kinds of textual variation that exist across these manuscripts. Can you talk a little bit about that issue of textual variation? What kinds of variation did you find to be really important here? And can you talk a little bit about your method in that case?
Sure. Well, in terms of, you know, there are lots of different kinds of variation, as you point out. I mean, in terms of just formal variation, as you said, I was looking at the different modes of presentation of the poem. Is it in scroll form? Is it in booklet form? How many characters are written per line? Is there any kind of punctuation? What's the handwriting like? I'm trying to get at, to some extent, what the different experiences of reading this poem would have been like. And I think that's something that we're, you know, in the modern West, I suppose in the modern world, we're at a really interesting moment where we've simultaneously lost any sense of what it was really like to deal with manuscripts, to deal with these very messy things put together by people who are not putting together a product that they were trying to sell. So we're kind of we're very far away from that world. At the same time, perhaps in a more radical way than has happened in a very long time, we're starting to confront the realities of reading texts in very, very different mediums. And I think, you know, those of us in the academy are now realizing, when we do searches for a book on our through our library's website, we're finding that there are certain books only available in digital copies. Mm-hmm. The experience of reading something on a screen is a very different one from reading something in a book. And the way those kind of characteristics carry over from book to screen, what gets jettisoned, how different it's going to be in 10 years, I think, you know, brings us to a greater awareness of these issues than people may have had even 50 years ago. So that got me thinking about what the experience of actually encountering poetry in the tongue was really like. Now, in terms of differences in content, and that's what I spent the most time on, I was interested in how the text changes as it gets transmitted over time and space. How do the characters change? Do they get changed into different forms? Do they get omitted? Do they get added to? Are they in fact replaced with different words? How do these kind of replacements work? What sorts of variants can we think of as likely errors? What kinds of variants can we think of as intentional revisions? Are there types of variation that can tell us something about how this poem might have moved through different formats across time and space? Do certain types of variation indicate that there was probably a memorial transmission? Do certain types of variants tell you that this poem was clearly copied by someone who had another written text at hand? And I found that whole process fascinating. It was very interesting to me as an intellectual exercise to look at a certain type of variant and say, okay, is this definitive proof of memorial transmission? Do we look at this variant and say the only way this could reasonably have happened is if somebody had memorized this poem and was passing it on through their memory? Can we know that, if that's the case, that the copy we have was written down from memory? Or can this variant tell us nothing more than at some point along the chain of variation, somebody had memorized the poem and it had changed in their mind somehow? And what's frustrating about that process is, in fact, how little you can know definitively about the text you're looking at. It's very possible that a variant in this text could have occurred 5, 10, 50 copies ago. You just don't know. There are some cases at the same time where you can see, and these are very exciting, how variation has crept into the specific physical text you're looking at, where you can see how a scribe must have skipped a line, realized it, gone back, crossed out a string of characters that he'd just written, and started again. And that kind of contact with another human being who was producing this physical text, over a thousand years ago, I found to be really moving in a lot of ways. Now, admittedly, I wasn't sitting in the British Library looking at these. I was looking at this at a photograph of this on my computer. And so I'm obviously removed a level from that. I'm touching what the Dunhuang scribe touched himself a thousand years ago. But I think those traces of humanity that you see there in the text, and knowing that somebody experience the poem Qinfuyin through this messy thing that I'm looking at in front of me, and somebody liked it enough to spend a fair amount of time copying it all down, really added a lot of meaning to what I was doing.
Do you think because you just sort of raised the issue of sitting in the British Library with the actual copies of the scrolls, do you think it would have changed anything for you in terms of the way you were looking at and writing about these documents if you did have these sort of I hesitate to say actual physical copies, because one of the things I think you're doing really brilliantly in this book is getting us to sort of rethink the idea of an original, right, or the original work, I think very productively. But do you think that would have changed anything for you?
I don't think that it would have changed the arguments that I ended up making. I think it would have changed. Maybe my emotional engagement with these objects in a certain way. I mean, there are things that you can do on the computer with these images that you can't do with the physical text in front of you the same way. Now, I think that itself brings up an interesting question, which is the things that I can do with the computer looking at these texts in terms of, and I'm thinking here of like, you know, blowing up characters. You take a really high definition photo and then you're blowing things up and you can look at them really closely. You can, on the one hand, you can get closer to that text. I mean, you literally get closer to those characters and see them bigger. At the same time, I suppose you are distancing yourself from that reading experience that somebody had a thousand years ago, because they couldn't do that. I suppose they could hold the thing up really close to their face, but they couldn't blow it up the way I blew it up on the computer. So when I'm making judgments about, oh, this is the character that this scribe actually wrote, or this is how he wrote this character accidentally, if I just had the text in front of me, and if I was a reader in Dunhuang in 940 or something, I might have missed those. So there is a distancing there as well. And I have to say, I hadn't really thought about that particular question until that particular issue until you asked me about that right now.
But I think it's actually we'll move on from this, but I think it's of a piece with the kind of argument that you're making in the work, and that there are various, one of the things you are really pointing us to is the variation and the productive variation in terms of not just composition of these texts, but also reading experiences, right? It's not,
yes.
I mean, these, it's not to say, I don't think there's anything inherently more, and I'm convinced even more from reading your book, that there's nothing inherently sort of better or more authentic, I think, by having the actual paper copy versus what you're doing. So
Yeah.
So a couple of the things that you mentioned in talking about this chapter, one of the things you mentioned, which I think is I'll just point to it verbally for readers, there's a really beautiful, I think, and very helpful account of how we might really read errors, or sort of giving us a new way of reading errors in the context of appreciating Tang poems as material objects. You also mentioned the issue of memory, and this brings us into the next chapter. So the next chapter looks at the content and the methods of memorial practices or memory practices in the medieval period, focusing on the Tang and focusing on poetry. Now, there are a couple of things I want to ask you here, but what I want to start out with is something that you mentioned earlier at the beginning of our conversation. You pointed out this chapter as the one that transformed or sort of radically changed perhaps the most from the first instantiation of this work to the book. Can you talk about those changes? Sort of what changed radically for you in working on this?
I think that one of the issues that hadn't really occurred to me as much at the beginning was that I guess I went in sort of thinking what I had learned to some extent, which is that people in this period had incredible memories and set huge amounts of text in those memories, and that they were so thoroughly trained that they could recite, you know, scroll after scroll after scroll without error, that when people were preparing for the civil service exams, they would essentially memorize, whole sets of the classics, what gets referred to as the memorization corpus, the Wenxuan, et cetera. And that's I think something that had sort of been taken for granted, and I think I didn't push too hard against that when I was writing the dissertation. I was more interested in looking at, okay, how did they do this? How was memory working? How did things change in the course of memorization? And the more I looked at what the sources were saying, and the more, and this is after the dissertation, the more I looked into the details of what people had to memorize for the exams and the ways they were actually tested on the exam, and the more I looked at European analogs from similar periods, or at least under somewhat similar cultural conditions, namely prior to the advent of print, where there was more limited textual availability and where you had an educational context that emphasized memorization, the more I was struck by the fact that people didn't seem to be memorizing things nearly as much as I had been led to believe. And that realization made me look more deeply into what these memorization techniques were like, and also whether or not they were actually particularly effective ones. I had kind of gone originally with the assumption that, of course, Chinese scholars in this period memorized huge amounts of text. They must have been great at memorizing. And in fact, I came away feeling that certainly they were better at memorizing than I am. But the techniques did not have the kind of efficiency and the kind of effectiveness that a lot of the more carefully articulated European techniques had. And, I think there are a lot of reasons for this. I think one of the, an obvious material explanation is simply that written texts were much more available in Tang Dynasty China than they were in the broadly defined medieval period in Europe. Textual production was much, much cheaper. And there were pretty substantial amounts, numbers of literate people. And so there were marketplaces for written texts to a much greater extent than there were in Europe at the time. So people didn't have the same need to memorize everything. And, there's more recent studies showing how our memories are being affected in, I suppose, negative ways or weakening ways, at least, by internet resources constantly at our disposal, that that we have facts there all the time. So I imagine that's one factor. I think there are other issues in terms of how the exams tested things and also the social context in which people learned and how they were learning. And I guess a lot of that thinking happened after the dissertation. It didn't really happen when I was writing the dissertation. And some of it actually happened in a very late stage of preparing the manuscript.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of discussion in this chapter of a kind of comparative there's a lot of comparative context that's understanding memory practices in Tang China alongside or compared with or in contradistinction to memory practices at a similar time in Europe. Did that kind of reading about these memory practices in Europe change the way you thought about this, or is that something that was in the first stages of this project as well?
Now, that changed a lot of how I was thinking about things. I had done some reading and European practices for the dissertation, but to be frank, it was rather cursory. And in the process of turning the dissertation into a book, I did much more reading in these, and I think much more careful reading. Part of that is because this was an issue that I found particularly interesting, and it was also an issue that I hadn't seen people write about for the Chinese case, even broadly defined, almost anywhere other than, you know, Jonathan Spence's book on Matteo Ricci. But I certainly had seen nothing about memory practices in medieval China in any language, and that intrigued me. I mean, it frightened me, I suppose, to some extent, but it also intrigued me. And because memory and memory practices, especially when they start to become articulated as practices, are a kind of technology, I found that an interesting way to think about what was going on. And in some ways, I would say issues that came up in the memory chapter have stayed with me more strongly moving into my next project. And I'm not going to get into that now, but there are a lot of questions that came up that I didn't feel I had the time or space to answer in this first book that I'm looking forward to looking into in more depth next.
Great. Now, what were some of those technologies of memorization that people were using in the Tang?
Well, that's one of the interesting things, was really the lack of memory technologies in the Tang. When you look at the European case, you think about things like memory palaces, the Loki method, the kind of journey method, all these different ways of situating bits of data in some kind of a spatial framework, really took advantage of the way the human mind has, or the human brain, I suppose, has evolved in the sense that we're more attuned to visual and spatial stimuli and thinking than we are to a lot of other ways of thinking about things. And the European practices take advantage of that. They use there's a real visual aspect to the text. And we know we've all seen this in illuminated manuscripts and ways in which the text incorporates a strong visual element. Now, the equivalent texts in the Tang, from what we know from both what we've seen in Dunhuang and what we've seen in the print culture that mimicked those types of formats, were radically different. Certainly there are texts with illustrations. They tended to be more religious texts. But if you think about the classics, if you think about texts that people had to learn for the exam, or texts that people had to learn to be an educated person, something like the Wenxuan, there is no visual element. You just have continuous running lines of text. And if you want to memorize something, that's a really bad format to have things in terms of memorizing something something quickly and efficiently. So that lack of technology in the case of the Tang I found really striking, and so it made me focus really on what is the method. And from everything that I could tell, for practical memorial purposes, the method was really rote memorization, reciting things again and again and again. Now, doing this does bring into play different senses. Recitation makes neural connections between what your mouth is doing, what your tongue is doing, what your ears are hearing. And if you do this while you're looking at a text, then obviously you do have a visual element there as well. But it's not something that was designed for memorial purposes the way a lot of the European texts were. It takes a lot more time, but there were things. I mean, it's clear that students would be tested on things repeatedly, asked to recite things repeatedly, and that type of structured practice we know is an aid to memory. So it's interesting to think about those things. I mentioned in there that somebody, Robert Ashmore at Berkeley, had mentioned after hearing a talk I gave that Lei Shu, these writings arranged by category, might be something that worked in a similar way. And I talked about that a little bit, and I think that's actually something very intriguing that I'd like to look at more in the future.
Yeah, that was one of the really interesting things about this chapter, is that you do bring us into the sort of the kinds of qualities based on, it seems like you're reading also of literature on the psychology of memory, that mm-hmm. do make memorization more fluid. So an expertise being one of them, phonology, issues of structuring of the text. These were all really interesting parts of this chapter. Now, you also, this also, the idea of recitation, or you're mentioning that, brings us into what you're looking at in the next chapter, which is focused on different functions and meanings of orality, the oral and Tang poetic culture. Now, you, I think, make a very convincing case here that orality was not a marker of something we might think of as, an immature literary culture, but it was a mm-hmm. conscious choice made by poets. So when we call a poetic culture like the Tang oral, when we talk about orality, what does that mean? Can you say a little bit about how orality functions in this context?
I think one of the most important and I suppose obvious ways that orality is working is simply that poetry, as far as we can tell, was essentially always read, recited out loud, and probably usually written out loud as well. So even when someone is writing a poem, they're, from what we can tell from, admittedly quite limited accounts, they're probably intoning to some degree. And, one of the reasons it seems like this is the case is we have accounts of somebody, writing poetry and somebody else, and when they're by themselves, alone in a room and complaining about, having someone else complain about how loud they are. And they're clearly not talking about the sound of the brush on the paper. Poetry is something that has a sound value all the time. And I think that's something that can get lost when we're reading it in a scholarly context. Now, I should note that there are plenty of scholars who have paid a lot of attention to the oral effects, A-U-R effects of poetry, of Tang poetry, and what it must have sounded like at the time. But I think the sense that poetry is something that's literally in the air, that people are hearing, that people are speaking out loud, is an important aspect of that. That it's clear that there are cases where people know a poem because they heard it. They'd never seen it written down. They heard somebody recite it and they remembered it. That when you met an old friend you didn't hand them a bunch of scrolls and say, you know, here are these poems I've been working on. Why don't you go take a look at them and we'll chat about them later. You recite them. You say, you know, would you like to hear some of my recent poems? And you recite them to the person. So there's that aspect all the time. And another important aspect is the clear ties between orality as a mode of authentic expression, and I would almost go as far as to say authentic moral expression, even, that grows out of the interpretive apparatus around the Shijing that, you know, really starts with the early stages of Chinese literary criticism and ways that poetry was conceived of from that point on.
Mm-hmm. Can you say a little bit more about this connection between orality of poetry and authenticity?
I think the conceit is, the kind of trope there is that the oral expression is spontaneous and is somehow, you know, truly expressing one's sure in a way that becomes, let's at least say, more complicated with writing and its possibilities of revision and so forth. And I'm well aware that this privileging the oral is a complicated thing in modern Western literary philosophical thought as well. But I think just speaking of the tongue, that was the association, that it's a spontaneous outburst of patterned sounds and tones, and, you know, to paraphrase the Yue Jing, and because of that, it's something that's to some extent beyond one's control, expressing something that's true and authentic. And the way that orality gets talked about in terms of poetic composition, at least in the Tang, does have a very heavy focus on spontaneity. I mean, there are other oral cultures in the world and in history where you have an entirely oral poetry that's never written down, but is composed over a period of time where somebody spends a long time mentally crafting a poem and saying the poem out loud to himself or herself, and then presenting a finished, carefully refined and revised product. That entire process has been oral and mental, but it doesn't have the type of connotation of spontaneity that I think orality brings with it in the tongue.
Now, one of the really interesting things that comes out of this chapter is that you're urging us to think about poems also in the context of a kind of economy. And so there's a really interesting discussion here about poetry perhaps as a kind of, or poems perhaps as commodities, and oral poetry in particular, the role of oral poetry in a marketplace. Can you speak a little bit to that issue?
Yeah, I think it's interesting the role that that oral poetry can play in a marketplace is very different from the role that a poem would play as a commodity itself. So if you're talking about buying and selling poems, that's very different. But in the kind of commercial context that oral poetry can play a part, it's important because it's a way to transmit information over time and space fairly quickly. Now, this can be information about a particular courtesan. It can be information about a particular establishment in the entertainment quarters. And it's functioning in certain contexts not that differently from advertising ditties, which, of course, typically rhyme and, you know, follow a basic simple meter that people find easy to remember. And I think poetry was working in a similar way in some of those contexts, that because it was short and easy to remember for a lot of the reasons I talked about in the second chapter, that it could transmit information, and that information had value. You know, information inherently has different types of of value to different people. But to pass on information about an establishment in the entertainment quarters makes that poem valuable to the establishment, makes it valuable to people who are looking for information about the best place to go or a place to avoid. It works in a similar context, I think, also in the entertainment quarters with courtesans. Now, oral poetry can also spread around gossip about people in a way that I think was playing out in this period as well. You know, another example I give in the book is a performance context. The poetry has value as a performance repertoire, that somebody who can perform a poem, you know, something, a Chang'an-ge is an example that I think I give here, a courtesan who claims that the claim is that because she could perform this lengthy poem in a certain way, that her marriage price, her value went up. And there, I think it's a case of the performance being particularly important, the ability to emphasize things in the right way. It's not that she was valuable because she had composed this poem, but that she could perform it in a way that added value to the poem, which in turn added value to her and her abilities. You know, if you think of, it's probably not, even though it's an entirely different context, if we think about the kind of American songbook and, you know, Ella Fitzgerald performing a song in a different way from how Frank Sinatra is going to perform that song. The song is, I suppose the song is the same, but they're doing something that adds value, and the song adds value to them as well.
Thank you. Now, the next chapter turns to the written aspect of poetry in the Tang. And written poetry in the Tang, as you show us, was not just poetry written on paper or similar materials, but also you bring us into the importance of poems being inscribed on materials other than the page. So inscribed on walls and objects on public locations and poems. You take us through the importance of poems sent by the postal service. So can you talk a little bit to this or speak a little bit to the processes of sort of writing and copying poetry? Because copying in particular becomes really important here and brings us back to these issues of materiality and textual variation that we looked at in the first chapter. What were actual copying practices like, and what were the implications of those practices for the circulation of poetry in the Tang?
There's a wide variety of copying practices. I mean, I think we can see this as ranging from, say, on the one hand, a son sitting down with scrolls of poems that his recently deceased father had written and carefully copying these down onto a new scroll that will be, or a new set of scrolls that will be his, or pieces of paper that are later pasted into scrolls, I guess, actually, pasted together to make a scroll, that will form his father's literary collection, that will be his legacy. Maybe this is something that's going to be presented to the court, presented to the, to the Imperial Library. And incredible care will be taken with something like that. So if we have that as one at one end of a spectrum, then at the other end, we could have someone in a post station far away from the capital who sees a poem that's written on a pillar in the post station, really likes it, and decides to jot it down himself, and writes it quickly on a scrap of paper that he has around after using a brush and ink or something, and is not going to do this with a particular amount of care. And even if we take those as two poles, both of them kind of hide a long process of copying that can be behind that. So the son carefully copying down his father's words, trying to maintain the utmost fidelity to those words, might in some cases be working with copies of poems that originally he got by going around to his father's friends and saying, "Hey, do you have any of my dad's poems sitting around? Or do you remember any of my dad's poems? Can you recite them for me?" And so as soon as we move back a step, we get back into these questions of what kind of textual fidelity is there at these different stages. And in some ways, I think even more interestingly, how important was that textual fidelity to the actors at the time? If the son asks his father's friend to recite one of his father's own poems, is the friend going to try really carefully to remember the poem exactly? Is he going to try to improve the poem as he's reciting it? Is he going to recite the poem that the son's father really should have composed, as opposed to the poem he did compose? Is he going to do that intentionally, or is he going to do that unconsciously? When somebody's writing down a poem from a post station wall, what if there's a line in it that they don't like? What if there's a line in it they think is awkward? What if they think they could write a better line? Are they going to change that? From what we've seen, from everything I could find in the process of this research, it seems to me that more likely than not, they would make those changes, that they didn't feel that was problematic, that authors expected works like this to change over the course of transmission, and indeed they did change over the course of transmission.
It's so interesting to think about these issues in terms of issues of authorship and how we understand the poem as an object, right? The poem is an individual object. Now, you bring up in this chapter, and it's also something that comes up a little earlier in the book, this issue of variation and the question of how much variation can there be in order for us to consider a bunch of these poems to be the same thing? To what extent or at what point does it become a new work? Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit? Just because it's a really fascinating kind of version of this Sorites paradox.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And I mean, and there's a reason why the Sorites paradox is a paradox, right? because it's hard to know when you move from being a pile to a heap. I always forget which one is what's bigger in the classical formulation of that. But I think there are cases where there are cases at either end that we can say when we have two versions of a poem, let's say, and in one of them there are a couple of radicals that were accidentally changed when somebody meant to write ch, you know, river, and they accidentally wrote ch, like the question word meaning why. We can see where that's a mistake, or it's a mistake that somebody is going to recognize as a mistake, that they're not going to read as anything other than a mistake, either because of its context in the line, because of the rhythm of the poem, because it's a mistake that lots of people make all the time. I saw this variant constantly in the Qin Fuyin poems and similar ones, writing cheng, meaning, you know, to become, cheng wei to cheng, versus, you know, cheng shi to cheng, forgetting to put in the earth radical there. So I think in those cases we can say, okay, this regulated poem of 40 characters with two things like this is not a different poem, right? But I think there are other cases where things are changed enough, in particular in lines that have received a lot of critical attention. And after writing the book, I ended up writing an article on Jiang Jinjiu, the Li Bai poem, like presenting, bringing in the ale. And in different versions of that, I found cases where lines that had received a lot of critical attention, indeed lines that had come in some ways to define the poem and were seen as lines that were typical of Li Bai, were lines that were not in certain versions of the poem. And I think when you get into that realm, then you really are talking about a different work, that you've crossed some sort of line, and that if you would read the poem as saying something very different or having a very different type of relation to its author, then I think you're moving into a realm where you have something that's reasonably different. I also think there are contexts in which, you know, I bring up some performative contexts where poems get chopped up and only certain sections get used, and they get reworked into a context where there's a kind of excited performance going on of a poem that originally may have been a very personal lament. And I think you can have a situation like that where even if in the portion that's being performed, nothing is changed from, and again, when I say nothing is changed from what? Even saying that assumes that we have some kind of set original. But say there's no alteration there, I think you're still dealing with a different work in a lot of ways. You're dealing with something that's been decontextualized and that's being given an entirely new meaning by a new performance context. And so I think when we're talking about how poetry existed and was experienced in the Tang, then a difference like that is a very meaningful difference. You know, the same way that if we hear Bruce Springsteen snarl "Born in the USA" at a concert protesting the Iraq War, that work is functioning in a radically different way than it is when George Bush is, you know, using it at a campaign stop in the in the late 80s, missing the message. So the context there really makes a difference.
Thank you. So as we sort of wrap up here, we don't have a whole lot more time. I would love to keep you actually for 2 hours, but I won't keep you for 2 hours. The final chapter of the book before the conclusion, I just want to just mention a couple of things that are really interesting here and then use it as a place to jump off and ask you two questions that move us from this very local case study to broader implications. And so this chapter, you've already mentioned a little bit about the issue of collecting poetry. And so this chapter looks at individual literary collections from various perspectives. And so you take us through the different kinds of processes that were involved in compiling literary collections in the Tang. You take us through the issue of prefaces to these compilations as sources of evidence. And there's a really wonderful, I think, for the historian especially, there's a really wonderful sense in which history comes into this, and the Anlushan Rebellion in particular, as something that really transforms or affects or has shaped even what poetry, what poetic corpus exists, what we have. And there's a really wonderful set of complaints about how entire sets of poems were destroyed based on because of this rebellion. And so I think there's a really interesting transdisciplinary discussion about poems as material objects here. Now, the chapter concludes by taking us from this very local case study of the Tang to comparing this with what happens after in terms of attitudes towards compilations and collections of poems. Can you speak a little bit to the distinction between what's happening in the Tang compared with what we see, for example, in the Song or later? How do things change significantly from what we've seen here in terms of collections?
Yeah, I think speaking very broadly, the real difference is one of attitude towards the poems as objects, really. How are people thinking of these? And in the Tang, I really had the sense that people approach the poems more often than not people who are compiling literary collections, if they're not just compiling it because it was dad's poems, but compiling collections for friends or putting together things, it's because they liked the poems. The basic mode was the mode of the fan. They were, again and again, the prefaces say, "Hao Shizhe," which, in some ways, I think is probably, though I didn't translate it this way, best translated as a fan. These poems will receive a lot of attention from fans. Fans will love these poems. That kind of relationship is I wouldn't say it's an uncritical relationship, because I think, we all know that fans can be the harshest critics. But it's a relationship with the texts, and I'm using texts more broadly here than just the physical copies, that is based much more on more pure enjoyment of what's coming out of that. They haven't been commoditized in the same way. There's not the same kind of curatorial sense that I think we start to see much more in the Song. Again, broadly speaking, the types of approaches we see in the Song are much closer to the types of almost scholarly approaches that we would take today, taking different texts, different copies of the same poem and collating them, trying to figure out what's the best text, trying to gather all the possible examples of this text that we can, trying to gather all of the poems by a certain person so that we have their poetic output, trying to restore something that was lost and get as accurate a picture of what this poetic output was really like. It's a more academic approach. And it's certainly not to say by any stretch of the imagination that you didn't also very much have the more kind of fan-oriented approach in the Song. Because I think there's no question that you did, that that you had people that were certainly reading these poems because they loved them. So it's not as much that the fan-type approach stops in the Song so much as the more academic approach, the more scholarly curatorial approach is not there in the Tang. I saw essentially no evidence of poetic, personal private literary collections really functioning that way, individual literary collections.
Thank you. Now, moving from the Song to an even wider discussion of implications, the last thing I want to ask you before we wrap up with a couple of closing questions is about the comments that you made in the book that gesture toward potentially broader implications of your focus case study to not just other time periods, but also potentially other fields. And you mentioned history, religion. Can you speak very briefly to what you think the broader implications are of this study for people working outside the field of literature?
I think essentially we're all dealing with texts, right? We're dealing, I shouldn't say that, of course, archaeologists and all sorts of people are dealing with all sorts of other types of material sources. But for those of us who are working primarily with texts, the question of the history behind the particular instantiation of this work in this particular text is a very important and meaningful one, because we're using these sources as evidence to say something about a period that we're distanced from chronologically, and these texts are serving as our way to get at that period. Well, if those texts are dramatically changed from the period we're trying to talk about, that's very meaningful. That changes the way that we approach those texts. It changes the way we think about that period. When we look at the poetry we have from the Tang, if we think we have Tang poetry, then we're going to get to a very different place from thinking that we have, 0.01% of Tang poetry. If we're talking about religious texts, the most obvious example here is something like Dunhuang, which has radically changed our understanding of the development of Chan Buddhism and the kind of the material aspects of Taoism and Buddhism in this period, the types of popular religious practices that people had. There's a lot of work being done right now on bamboo manuscripts and manuscripts from earlier periods. And, I'm certainly uninformed about this, relatively speaking, but it seems clear that it's opening up whole new worlds of understanding what the actual intellectual and social context of these periods was really like. What does it mean when these texts change over time to our understanding of what they're saying and what the period is really like? And I think any text-based field should be thinking very carefully about these questions. And I think we are starting to see that in a lot of cases. I think there's a much deeper understanding of print culture in the in the Song and later periods than there was not that long ago, because there's been important work by Lucille Jha and others on those types of topics, and they change the way we think about texts, and they change the way we think about historical evidence.
Thank you. Well, Christopher, this has been wonderful for me. There's clearly a ton in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about. Is there anything before we wrap up in particular that you'd like to mention for listeners that we haven't had a chance to talk about, but that you think is important or crucial?
I don't know. I just think that I think one of the things that motivated me through all of this was a desire to have a better understanding of how this literature existed for the people who created it and the people who first received and enjoyed it. And that there are contexts in which we're naturally going to distance ourselves from that when we're thinking about things critically. But I think it's something that we should never forget, that these things originated in a particular type of social, cultural, and material context. And that if we don't pay attention to how somebody read or heard or composed or spoke a poem in the Tang or a religious dialogue in the Song, then we're missing something that's vitally important to our understanding of that period, of that discourse, and of those people. And I'm really glad that this happened to be something that I was curious about, not for any particularly deep reason at the beginning, but I think partly because I came to the literature kind of late. I wondered, how the heck did people get poems? How did people get a poem in the Tang? I mean, I know they didn't go to a store and buy a book of poems. How did they get them? And I think that basic question led to pretty much everything else that ended up happening in the book.
So now that the book is out, and congratulations on that, you've alluded to earlier in our conversation the next project. What's inspiring you right now? What are you working on now that the book's done?
I'd really like to direct. No, I'm just kidding. Sorry. The next project is looking at ways of organizing and transmitting and using what I am broadly calling literary information. And, you know, obviously this comes out of some of the concerns that I had in this first book. I'm interested in how people put literature to use in a variety of different contexts. In obviously, the exam is the most obvious context, but there are also all sorts of social contexts and all sorts of compositional contexts where the literary inheritance is essentially used as a kind of information base from which to build these new products. And I'm looking at, in part, prefaces to anthologies, and I didn't deal with anthologies in the first book for a couple of different reasons, but one of the reasons is they prefaces to anthologies tended not to go into much detail about how the material objects were collected, whereas prefaces to individual literary collections talked about that a lot more. So they just didn't give me the kind of information that I needed. But for this next project, I'm really more interested in ways people thought about that information, ways they grouped it, ways they categorized it, ways they kind of sifted through it and discarded some of it. Something that comes up again and again in prefaces to anthologies is that one of the goals of a given anthology is to pick out the best examples of X so that other people don't have to wade through everything to, you know, get to these finest examples. And that's really a form of information management. Things like Lei Shu are something that I want to look at in a lot more detail. What does it mean to take something that was a whole poem and chop it into little bits and have one bit in a section about how to talk about the moon and another bit in a section about how to, you know, talk about orchids or chrysanthemums or something like that. Suddenly you have these lines taken away from their original artistic aesthetic context, and then they're going to be reused. I mean, it's a form of sampling, essentially. And what are the aesthetic implications of doing this? What does it say about the way people thought about the literary inheritance? And that's, you know, pretty broad, but those are the kind of questions that are animating me going into the next project.
Well, that sounds great. And thank you so much for talking with us today, Christopher. It's been great fun for me, and the book is fantastic. So thank you.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed it. I'm surprised at how much I enjoy talking about it, actually.
Thank you. You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks so much for being with us today, and we'll see you again next time.